Monday, June 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, another African American killed by police sparks fresh outrage and expanded protests.
I do not believe that this was a justified use of deadly force.
As more U.S. states and nations worldwide end their COVID-19 lockdowns, health officials warn the pandemic is still here. Also ahead, hundreds of fans defy police in Kenya as they mourn the death of a popular musician. It's all on today's International Edition. More large protests have broken out across the United States after a deadly police shooting in Atlanta, Georgia. The death of another African American has further fueled the unrest and demonstrations against racism and police brutality. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, the call for bipartisan legislation addressing police reform nationwide has grown as protests across the country and the world continue.
On Friday night, Atlanta police officers approached 27-year-old Rashard Brooks, who appeared to be asleep behind the wheel of his car while waiting in line at a fast food restaurant drive-thru. When officers tried to detain Brooks, he resisted arrest, leading to a scuffle. In the moments that followed, recorded in a series of police body cameras, restaurant surveillance footage, and bystander cell phone videos, Brooks appears to use one of the officers' tasers as he flees. The incident ends when one of the officers opens fire, leading to Brooks' death.
While there may be debate as to whether this was an appropriate use of deadly force, I firmly believe that there is a clear distinction between what you can do and what you should do. I do not believe that this was a justified use of deadly force and have called for the immediate termination of the officer.
A day later, the officer who pulled the trigger was fired, the Atlanta police chief resigned, and the fast food restaurant where the incident occurred was engulfed in flames as anger over Brooks's death led to unrest on the streets of Atlanta, in a country already on edge in the wake of previous deadly police encounters.
We need reformation of how police officers do their jobs, how law enforcement does its job. Because what happened yesterday to Rashard Brooks was a function of excessive force and the decision that the fact that they were either embarrassed or, panicked led them to murder a man who they knew only had a taser in his hand.
There has been a disconnect with what our expectations are and should be as it relates to interactions with our officers and the communities in which they are entrusted to protect.
It's a disconnect lawmakers in Washington are increasingly under pressure to resolve with bipartisan legislation that addresses police reform, especially in the wake of the recent death of George Floyd in police custody in Minneapolis. Republican Senator James Lankford from Oklahoma says he would support a ban on police use of chokeholds.
There's been a longstanding principle out there that is not needed for that situation. And there's been a consensus document that was done in 2017 by law enforcement around the country to say that that is not needed. So I think that's not an issue for us.
Former New Jersey governor and Republican candidate for president in 2016, Chris Christie, points to successes in police reform in the city of Camden, New Jersey, as an example for other communities to follow.
We got police officers out of their cars, onto bicycles, on foot, and embedded them in the community, both from a law enforcement perspective and socially, George, working with the communities and working with young men and women in the communities to develop trust. Second was de-escalation training. And the watchword for the de-escalation training is first do no harm, and that violence is a last resort.
While lawmakers in Washington seek to find common ground on legislation, some states have already passed sweeping police reforms in response to the protests that have dominated headlines across most American cities over the last several weeks. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News.
An effort to remove the names of Confederate leaders from U.S. military bases is gaining traction with lawmakers from both parties, setting up a clash between President Donald Trump, who has promised a veto. White House correspondent Patsy Wuttakuswara has the story on the debate over Confederate symbols at a time when protests over the deaths of African Americans at the hands of police has forced the nation to reckon with systemic racism.
Henry Lee has completely whipped the enemy and swept the Yankee army northward from Virginia.
Gone with the Wind is a 1939 Oscar-winning film that depicts the antebellum South and the Confederacy, 11 states that fought to preserve slavery in the American Civil War of the 1860s.
Ladies, the Confederacy asks for your jewelry on behalf of our noble cause.
It has been removed by streaming service HBO Max, which cited racial prejudices. Dozens of statues of Confederate figures have been removed or vandalized, while the race car body NASCAR has banned the Confederate flag on its racetracks. These symbols have emerged as a flashpoint since the death of George Floyd in police custody in Minneapolis that triggered weeks of protests nationwide. Steve Phillips is founder of Democracy in Color and host of a podcast by the same name.
There's just something very visceral about having to look at the glorification of the people and the symbols that really wanted to have you, your people, and people who look like you held in chattel slavery.
Another front in the battle, 10 Army bases that bear the names of Confederate officers, including Fort Bragg, Fort Hood, and Fort Lee. With military leadership signaling support, a Republican-led Senate panel has approved the plan from a Democratic senator to remove these names from military installations.
This is the right time for it. And I think it sends the right message.
They're set to clash with President Donald Trump, who has threatened a veto. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany.
These monumental and very powerful bases have become part of a great American heritage and a history of winning, victory, and freedom.
The 1776 U.S. Declaration of Independence states that all human beings are created equal. Yet, while slavery was abolished in 1865, African Americans continue to endure the devastating effects of discrimination until now. Confederate symbols are emblematic of that paradox.
Here is a symbol of that represents the persistence of that ongoing contradiction between equality declared but equality denied.
Hunter said that while politics is about compromise, culture is about the things that are sacred, that people do not want to compromise over. By taking sides in a culture war, Trump will likely deepen polarization ahead of the November election. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
The role of the U.S. military has come under intense scrutiny amid civil unrest erupting in the U.S. after the death of African-American George Floyd, who died in police custody last month. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb explores the importance of the military's long tradition of remaining apolitical in order to best represent and protect the American people it serves.
The use of force against peaceful protesters in Lafayette Square by federal law enforcement, backed by the U.S. military's National Guard, sparked a nationwide debate about the role of the military in civil society.
And it created an image, I think, that I think, again, gets after this idea of eroding the trust and confidence of the military.
General Joseph Votel, the former commander of U.S. Central Command, who now serves on the executive board of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania, tells VOA the military's core value to stay out of domestic politics is among its greatest assets.
An apolitical military serves the nation the best. It's what the intentions were of the founders, and it is one of the very important reasons why the American military remains the most respected institution in America.
Several retired top-ranking officers have spoken out after a presidential threat to deploy thousands of active-duty troops to U.S. cities, a move intended for only the most extreme circumstances, and this audio leak of Defense Secretary Mark Esper speaking to governors about the protest.
And so, at my urging, I agree, we need to dominate the battle space.
When we can focus on the potential conflict in terms of dominating our own cities and our own people, it scares me to death, quite frankly. And if we don't do something about it, we'll look back and recognize this moment. This was the moment where really we need to do something.
Esper and the top U.S. military officer also walked in Lafayette Square with the president moments before he posed for photos outside a nearby church damaged during protests the night before. Pentagon officials have stressed that neither Milley nor Defense Secretary Esper knew of the president's plans and had only agreed to go to the square to thank National Guard members for their service. Esper has said he regretted his battle space comments, and Milley on Thursday called his decision to accompany the president in the square a, quote, mistake that he had learned from.
I should not have been there. My presence in that moment and in that environment created a perception of the military involved in domestic politics.
The military's apolitical nature is more than a tradition. It's in the military oath of office taken by every service member.
They're not swearing to support and defend the president, any president, whether he or she be Republican or Democrat. They're swearing to support and defend the Constitution.
Former officials have raised concerns that the president oftentimes ignores or forgets this very point.
The president has been really accumulating a sense of ownership about the government, where he make statements about the, this is my military, or my generals, or my judges, so that it becomes possessive.
And with a presidential election less than 5 months away, some worry that the current debate about the military's role in domestic issues won't be the last.
The military is going to be really tested because this president will try to draw them into his political agenda.
Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
At least 15,000 people demonstrated in Paris over the weekend, inspired by the growing movement against racism and police brutality in the U.S. In a televised address on Sunday aimed at how the country will move beyond the coronavirus crisis, French President Emmanuel Macron called for unity as his own government faces growing pressures when it comes to racial inequality and police violence. Joining us to talk more about it is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. So, Catherine, President Macron wanted to focus on rebuilding France's economy, but obviously the question came up and he couldn't avoid at least addressing the growing calls of the Black Lives Matter movement.
It was expected that he'd address the Black Lives Matter movement. He didn't actually mention those words, though. He didn't say Black Lives Matter. He did say that when it came to France, that in France, racism and anti-Semitism and discrimination are unacceptable. He also acknowledged, and this is very unusual, he acknowledged that someone's address, name, or color of skin can reduce their chances at succeeding in French society. It's very unusual for a French president to say that. It just goes to show that this is a new president. This is a president who's prepared to pull aside the curtain of this great curtain that sets everyone as one, a nation united, regardless of their ethnicity. The fact that he said that is really is a step forward. When it came to other issues, such as we've seen, for example, in the United Kingdom and other places around the world about talk of taking down statues that are tied to France's slave trade or colonial wrongs, President Macron said quite clearly that the Republic will not erase any trace or any name from its history. He then went on to say it will not take down any statue. And he did say that there was a need to look at all of our history together, including, he said, relations with Africa. But he said that has to be done as a way of seeking truth, not as a way of denying who we are.
And Catherine, what was the main purpose for Macron's big speech on Sunday? I'm sure that the issue with Black Lives Matter was expected to come up, but what was his purpose overall for coming out and speaking to the nation?
It was really to say that France is reopening. From today, France is open. Monday morning is going to be like many other Monday mornings across the nation. And that comes a week early. It had been expected that the center of France, particularly in the greater Paris region, might not be able to reopen completely. But yes, the whole of France is reopened. And that also means that it comes on the day when most of the European nations will also be open for travel between European nations, the 27 EU nations. You'll be able to move to most countries, particularly Portugal and Spain are holding back, but most of the other countries are opening their borders. He also announced that come July 1st, there will be the possibility of travel from outside of the EU into France and from France to areas outside of the EU, but that will, of course, depend on the countries of which people are going to. So it was essentially a message to the French people to say, look, we've been through the worst of it when it comes to saving lives, but the real tough job starts now, and that's the economy. And that was when he announced that there'll be something like 500 billion euros given to help businesses get over this economic crisis that was caused by the lockdown. And he's also made a point of saying that this is a new start for France. This is a new beginning. And he wanted that new society to be stronger, to be more just, and to be an ecological economy. He talked a lot about a green economy. And he said that is the way that he hopes this country will go.
Paris-based journalist Catherine Field, thank you so much. Black Lives Matter protests attracted large crowds in Australia over the weekend in defiance of government warnings about COVID-19. The marches have been inspired by the mass gatherings in the U.S. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Across Australia, thousands of anti-racism demonstrators rallied against high rates of Indigenous incarceration, deaths in custody, and the removal of Indigenous children from their families. Aboriginal Australians make up about 3% of the population, but almost a third of prison inmates are Indigenous. This Aboriginal woman said she wanted justice for her people.
We're here to support, you know, our future as Indigenous people and to walk against the injustices of what happens to our people.
In Perth, Western Australia, they defied calls by the authorities Saturday not to attend because of COVID-19 fears. Organisers handed out masks and hand sanitizer. An earlier march in Sydney was ruled unlawful by the Supreme Court on public health grounds, but hundreds of people joined the protest.
I'm here because there's been 437 deaths in custody since 1991, so I'm here to make a stand. And I don't care that the government has said this is illegal.
New South Wales Assistant Police Commissioner Mick Willing wasn't happy protesters had ignored coronavirus health orders.
It's disappointing to acknowledge that around 300 people chose to ignore the warnings that had been given by police in terms of coming to this public gathering.
There have been separate rallies in Australia by groups protesting the treatment of asylum seekers and refugees. The government had urged demonstrators to stay home because of concerns that mass gatherings could spread COVID-19, which has been mostly contained in Australia. Two women were arrested after a statue of the British explorer Captain James Cook was defaced in Sydney. Another was damaged in Perth. However, Peter Dutton, Australia's Home Affairs Minister, criticised calls to remove statues of European colonists in Australia as an obscure left-wing cause. This year has marked the 250th anniversary of Cook's voyage to Australia. British settlement would begin 17 years later. Historical monuments across the world have been torn down in recent weeks by anti-racism campaigners following the death of African-American man George Floyd in U.S. police custody in Minneapolis last month. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
U.S. President Donald Trump has bowed to pressure over an election rally scheduled to take place in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on the Juneteenth anniversary that commemorates the end of U.S. slavery. Trump's decision to hold his first campaign rally in months on that day in a city notorious for a 1921 massacre of its black citizens had prompted fierce criticism in the face of nationwide protests. The rally has been pushed to the following day, but is being called a dangerous move for another reason. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports health officials are concerned about the threat of coronavirus as thousands are expected to gather for the indoor event.
After months away from the campaign trail, President Trump plans to rally supporters next weekend in Tulsa, Oklahoma, despite the concerns of health officials. The head of Tulsa's health department says it is an honor for the city to host a sitting president, just not during a pandemic. Oklahoma has a relatively low death rate from COVID-19 compared with the rest of the nation, but new cases have been rising, and Saturday's rally is scheduled for a 19,000-seat arena. The city's health chief, Bruce Dart, tells the Tulsa World he's concerned about protecting anyone who might attend such a large indoor event, including the president. But Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson, himself a doctor, tells ABC's This Week,
"It is very important that we utilize what we have learned about the disease so that we can live with it rather than allow it to dominate us."
Ben Thomas, Washington.
New coronavirus cases and hospitalizations in record numbers are being seen in many U.S. states, including Florida and Texas. Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA News. After weeks with almost no new coronavirus infections, there are now concerns of a resurgence in Beijing. The city says it has recorded dozens of new cases in recent days, all linked to a major wholesale food market. The sister of North Korea's leader is warning of retaliatory measures against South Korea that could involve the military. It's the latest escalation of tensions over defectors from the North who've been sending back propaganda and food. Kim Yo-jong, who serves unofficially as one of Kim Jong-un's top aides, issued the warning in a statement carried by state news agency KCNA. A group of African countries has sent a letter to the president of the UN Human Rights Council calling for a debate on racially inspired human rights violence when the council meets next week. The request was sparked by the death of African-American George Floyd while in police custody in the U.S. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In its letter, the African group says the events that have unfolded since the May 25th death of George Floyd have sparked protests globally against the injustice and brutality that people of African descent face daily in many parts of the world. It says the current racially inspired human rights violations, systemic racism, police brutality, and violence against peaceful protest makes a debate airing these festering issues a matter of great urgency. It says the death of George Floyd is not an isolated issue. The group of African ambassadors that drafted the letter notes many people of African descent have suffered the same fate due to unchecked police brutality. However, the crimes have gone largely unnoticed. UN Human Rights spokesman Rolando Gomez tells VOA the debate is likely to occur at the Council Tuesday or Wednesday when the UN body takes up Agenda Item 9, which deals with issues of racism and discrimination.
Structural racism and police violence are issues which are commonly raised by states and civil society at meetings of the Council, as are unlawful killings by police and racial bias in policing. And the aim, of course, is to prevent such abhorrent acts.
The African group's letter to the council president notes the uprising in the U.S. is a protest against systemic racism that produces state-sponsored racial violence and impunity for the perpetrators. It adds the protests the world is witnessing are a rejection of the racial inequality and discrimination suffered by Black people and other people of color in the United States. Earlier this week, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Andrew Bremberg, issued a statement expressing American horror, anger, and grief at the senseless death of George Floyd. He said the public reaction following this grave tragedy demonstrated the American people's desire to overcome racial injustice and to achieve a more equal and just society. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA's International Edition continues. In our new reality of social distancing due to the COVID-19 pandemic, there has been a massive spike in the use of video and online tools to conduct work, speak to doctors, connect with our isolated loved ones, and even have mental health counseling. But there are implications, both culturally and psychologically, from this new normal mode of communication. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Zoom with Sherry Turkle, professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who tells him she's been intrigued to see many of her students preferring communicating by text rather than face-to-face.
And I started to interview them about it, and it was clear that it made them feel less vulnerable.
How so?
You never know what the other person is going to say, and you have to make it up in real time.
If you put it that way, in-person communication does seem a bit more stressful.
That's true, but talking face-to-face also means you can make eye contact, you can take in the full body and gestures and voice. You pick up so many cues about what's really going on.
So how does Zoom compare with what you learned about texts? You're face-to-face in a sense, but it's still on a computer.
Well, I've been doing some interesting studies that show that for some purposes, you really are better off with a telephone call. The focused attention that you can give a voice is better than Zoom. That's why radio hasn't disappeared. Now, for teaching, for meetings, when partners and families can't be together, I think Zoom is very good for that. And, you know, clearly people are doing very creative things with Zoom. I'm teaching on Zoom and I'm working very hard to make those classes exciting. But I'm looking at 30 little postage stamp faces. And if you're just seeing me on a screen with a fake background, it's not natural.
So face-to-face is more natural, in your opinion, because there's more human emotional information in it.
Part of what we say when we say face-to-face is we really mean body-to-body. How does a mother know their child is anxious? Through so many dimensions of how their muscles and neck are sitting, how their forehead is sitting. And in Zoom, you never are looking at the person's eyes. You know, I don't want to sound churlish or, you know, negative, because I'm grateful to this technology. Were it not for this technology, I would not be able to teach my classes. I think my classes this semester have been extraordinary for me, have given me a deep insight into the experience of my students, which has been very difficult. And I think we're all very sustained together in these classes. But here's what I worry about. I worry that there are going to be a lot of businesses and a lot of small universities and a lot of enterprises that are going to say, you know what? It's really cheaper to do all this on Zoom. But after all, it probably did 60% of what we need, and 60% is good enough for us. And I worry that we're going to be losing the wrong 40% of what we need as educators, of what we need as healers, as what we need as people.
So you would advise against using Zoom in most cases?
Well, it depends what our purpose is. All technology depends on what you want to use it for.
That was Sherry Turkle, professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. Hundreds of mourners and fans of popular musician Bernard Obonyo, also known as A. Benny Jachiga, defied police in the western Kenyan city of Kisumu on Friday, preventing his funeral from taking place. The region has strict guidelines for burials of suspected COVID-19 cases, and bodies are required to be buried within 6 hours, with only 5 relatives attending the funeral. But despite police efforts to disperse the crowds with tear gas, the group swarmed the cemetery and took the casket, saying burying Obonyo so quickly would be disrespectful. They demanded a larger funeral for fans to be able to pay their respects. Obonyo died on Thursday, June 11th, after complaining of chest pains. It's not clear whether he had been tested for the new coronavirus. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Take care and be well. Simba manyo eno, katika kalo kamino kino.
Simba manyo endo akatita kala kamino kinyo Simba manyo endo wapondita kala nyakwanyo bela Simba manyo endo wapondita kala nyakwanyo bela Simba manyo endo alamedo gakala nyakwanya moko Simba manyo endo alamedo gakala nyakwanya moko Simba manyo endo polwe nyakala kamino kinyo.